Group meeting, Sunday, 21st September, 1986. Through Him who is whole and pure, the world awakens out of unknowing communion into perfect communion. What do we mean by unknowing communion? The fact of universal existence is that everything in the world is in communion. I start that chapter by saying, all the world is in communion. For communion is relationship, and everything exists in relationship with everything else. If we see a boulder lying on the earth, we think of that boulder as something inanimate. But that boulder lying on the earth is in communion with the earth. The communion of contiguity. It is in touch with the earth. And in that way it is related to the earth. We, of course, possessing consciousness in the manner that we do possess consciousness, can experience communion in much deeper and profounder ways. And when we can experience communion in the transcendental way, then one of the great purposes of our human existence is fulfilled. And that capacity for communion and the realization of that communion means that our ordinary everyday consciousness, which functions in terms of the finite and temporal, and therefore the mortal, is transmuted into what I call holistic consciousness, which excludes nothing whatsoever, but is inclusive of everything. This does not mean that you are aware of the functioning of the total cosmos all the time. Oh no. Our heads might burst if we try to do that. But it means that if and when something reaches our own brain externally or internally through memory or whatever it is, then we are in perfect communion with it. If you can see this clearly, you will understand more and more how and why some of the scriptures relate quite unusual and extraordinary things. To give one example from the Buddhist scriptures, when the Buddha says, even as a strong man can put out his arm suddenly, or draw in his arm suddenly, the Buddha could move into the realm of the 33 gods, whatever the 33 gods represented. But you see, if your consciousness can function in terms of infinity and eternity, neither space nor time can limit you in any way as far as your consciousness is concerned. This is the important thing. Because what is the special thing which distinguishes the human being from every other animal species? We are an animal species physically. But what is it that distinguishes us from every other animal species? Our consciousness and the way our consciousness can function, can develop, and can reach a transcendental fruition which no animal can reach. You see? So that's why this state of communion is so important, because it marks the end point of the development of your own individual consciousness. You can't develop it positively as if you were developing consciousness itself. one's consciousness depends upon the nature, the quality of one's own psyche and mental activities. If the psyche is completely pure, then mind in its transcendent reality can function through you. What is this thing which I call the psyche? Mind itself is an archetypal energy. It is a form in which the primordial creative energy, which is the origin of the whole universe, functions. When that type of energy meets the body, then through the brain and nerves, the nervous system, and the activity of the ductless glands and the state of the bloodstream, etc., you develop the ability to think and feel, to talk and function, as we say, intellectually, emotionally, and so forth. That is your psyche. The psyche belongs to you. Mind doesn't. To say my mind is a mistake. My psyche, yes, but not my mind, because mind is this universal, transcendent form of energy which the primordial creative energy takes in order to function through a human being. This is, I think, is a point which may be new to our day and age. But there are those who have woken up to it, who are waking up to it. So now, my psyche, but not my mind. Similarly, it is a mistake to talk in terms of my immortal soul or spirit. Because whatsoever is immortal is eternal and infinite. It is universal. It is not the property of a particular living organism. So you see, that functions, a pure mind comes into play when the psyche no longer offers any obstruction to pure mind. Because, you know, our thoughts and feelings are not exactly all perfect or saintly or even human in the true sense. We have an unfortunate mistaken phrase in the languages of the world. Humanum est errare. It is human to err. That is entirely wrong. It is subhuman to err. And I'm not using the term subhuman pejoratively, because we members of the human species are still evolving towards the perfection of humanness and humanity. We are slowly evolving towards it. We are still in the sub-stages, not in the complete human stage. That is why I use the term subhuman without needing to apologize for it. So you see, in this subhuman stage, the psyche shows good and bad qualities. It shows the ability to function in tune with the universal process, in tune with whatsoever is working towards human fulfillment, or to obstruct it. We have ample evidence in our own day and age, just as we have ample evidence throughout all history, of the subhumanity, and in so many instances, especially nowadays it's noticeable, the inhumanity of those who are called human beings in the world. It's important to have some sort of glimpse, at least, some sort of clear consciousness of the nature of our existence and the way we are evolving. Now, until we have realized our full humanity, we are in that subhuman stage. And although we are in the subhuman stage, still we are in communion with totality. Because the universe is so constructed that every single thing is related, intimately related, to every other single thing in the universe. Only we, being what we are blind to that fact. We can't see it. And not only can't we see it intellectually, but still worse, we cannot live as if we were truly conscious of it. There is a great difference between being truly conscious of something and just knowing it intellectually. Many wonderful ideas, thoughts, have been put out through the centuries. But that doesn't mean that that idea or thought has sufficient potency in our own daily life to make us live in accord with that wonderful thought or idea. To be able to live in tune with that idea, we have to be clearly conscious of it. Consciousness is a curious thing. What you are truly conscious of will naturally and spontaneously, invariably, it will express itself through all your thought and feeling, your speech and your action. You know how we say, when we really are conscious of something, "Oh, I can't help it. That is my nature. I do it like that." And we say, your poet or your musician is born, not made. That means he is clearly conscious in that manner which prevents him from not putting forth poetry or music. He cannot help himself. It happens that way. And that is the great difference, I should say, between being conscious and holding an idea, a belief, or a thought. Now, we'll go on. What a lot comes out of a single sentence. The world does not know it. That is, this business of the world awakens out of unknowing communion. The world does not know it, but he who has woken up is a light. In the darkness, he is the light of the world, and his awakened state is the timeless communion of the nameless unknown with all the world, through him, the star of truth, the heart of love. That's something we must never forget. We all, human beings as they are, we think in terms of achievement, of attainment. That's nonsensical. We attain nothing, we achieve nothing. It is transcendence, the totality, which realizes its own transcendence and perfection in particular forms throughout all existence. The perfect flower, for instance, is transcendence realizing its perfection through the flower. The perfected human being, the perfected Holy One, is the human form through which transcendence realizes its transcendence in human form. It's human transcendence. You see the folly then of the people of the world throughout the centuries in trying to describe God. You can't describe that which is totally beyond you. for God in reality, or I use the word transcendence by preference because the word God has become so loaded and spoiled. God in reality is the unknown, remains the unknown, and I might almost say is the unknowable. When the great mystics and the great founders of the religions have said that they realized God, Jesus, for example, said, I and my Father are one, and so on, you see. Ahura Mazda in Zarathustrianism is on speaking terms with God. So was Adam. And then again, in the Old Testament, we have Moses and Jacob, was it? Or who spoke with God, and so forth, you see. Well, that was a way of talking which wasn't quite accurate. It is the transcendent which realized itself through these people in human form. So the transcendent always remains the nameless unknown, but he, the person through whom transcendence manifests, is the star of truth, the heart of love. Wisdom and love always go together, and truth means wisdom. There is no such thing as wisdom by itself without love. Mahakaruna is always associated with Mahaprajna. The truly loving man is the wise man. And the wise man is the truly loving man. You know how we in our ordinary life are awful interferers. We think that our neighbor or friend or whoever it is making a mistake, and we rush in and argue with him and spoil the relationship with him. We have the conceit. I've done it myself throughout my life. So I know what I'm talking about, you see. We rush in and say, no, look, you do this, that, and that. That'll be much better for you, and so forth. Who am I to dictate to another embodiment of transcendence, just as I am an embodiment of transcendence, but unawake yet to transcendence? Who am I to dictate to somebody else? You see, these very subtle forms of human conceit absolutely bedevil our social relations and also our international relations and so forth. The star of truth. Now, you know what a star is? It is a self-shining light. It's important to realize this. A star is a self-shining light. In the human kingdom, how many such people have we witnessed? We have witnessed perhaps only one or two. But historically, we know there have been a dozen or so, and that's about all. Self-shining lights. And that is what we need on earth. One profound meaning of the kingdom of heaven on earth is just that human beings shall be self-shining lights. Because as we say, the stars shine in the heavens. They don't shine in the heavens, they shine in space, of course, we know that, but still it's convenient to talk in those terms. It's a poetic expression. But poetic expressions are often very, very near the truth. And in fact, the truth usually is expressed poetically. To be thus, that is, in communion, is man's religious fulfillment. And since man essentially and fundamentally is a religious being, and only secondarily very secondarily is he an economic, political, and social animal. This psychophysical organism, which is called a human being, is an animal organism. And it's only the animal part of us which is concerned with and which needs politics, economics, and social relationship. But the real human within us is the religious part of us. Because the real human in us is transcendence itself. God himself, if you like. Avra Mazda himself. Or any of the great teachers. Krishna himself embodied in us. Shiva. You know how in the Kundalini Yoga they say, Shiva resides here, is in touch at the Sahasrara Chakra with the human being. So, being in communion, this is the heart of religion, meaning of religious living. The doctrines and the dogmas may be of some use to stimulate us in the right way. All too often, unfortunately, they don't stimulate us in the right way. They stimulate us in the wrong way. And the rituals are useful for those people who are sensitive to, who have that kind of sensitivity. They respond to ritual just as so many of us can respond to great art or philosophy or science and so on, you see. So that way the rituals are useful. They lift you into a mood of sublimity even, you see. But as such, they have no special value. They do not transform you into the new man, the true human. The true human is the happy or blissful creator. That's its true meaning. In the distant dawn of his emergence, man, like the very creature out of which he evolved, that is the primate, the peak point of the monkey tribe, that creature was in unknowing communion. So is man too. Adam and God were on speaking terms with each other, a teaching which calls for deep contemplation. You see, you know the meaning of the word Adam. The meaning of the word Adam, the name Adam, is he of the ground. He who was created out of the ground. In the second chapter of Genesis, that is presented as the Lord God taking some dust and so forth and making a man. That is the usual understanding of it. That is the wrong meaning of it. I'll tell you the right meaning. He's so clever, he knows, isn't he? I believe the right meaning is this. He of the ground which is the origin of the totality. That is known as the ground. The great mystics who realized communion, the great founders of the religions and so forth, who realized communion, they realized in perfection that they were of the ground, the ultimate supreme, the origin itself of totality. So that is the real meaning, I think, of he of the ground. And that's what the Hebrew word Adam means. Child man, I said child man, meaning in the distant past, was receptive, responsive, directly and in simple terms, because mind was fresh and innocent. Innocent, not merely in the sense in which a little baby is innocent, but it means innocuous, harmless. And it's a very interesting thing that harmlessness is one of the qualities on which Sri Krishna in the Gita lays outstanding emphasis. For instance, when he gives that long list of qualities which characterize the yogi, the true yogi, he starts off by saying harmlessness. And harmlessness is an absolute condition for anyone who practices meditation to be able to reach the profounder and right up to the profoundest stages of meditation. Harmlessness. I said a little while ago, we are awful interferers with life. We are constantly harming life, aren't we, in the world? When I say we, I don't mean just you and I. I occasionally do, but the human race as a whole is a rather harmful race. Man is the greatest predator in the world today. We know that. And his behavior towards his fellow human beings is not exactly humane or harmless. So, innocent means to be harmless. It did not work upon itself, that innocent mind. So, man lived in delight. The Garden of Eden, the name, the Hebrew word Eden, the Hebrew name Eden, means delight. He lived in a state of delight. What sort of delight? Remember that we are talking of God having created the Garden of Eden and man living in it, primordial man and woman living in it. What is this delight? It is something ineffable. Something which is utterly peaceful, which is utterly harmless, which has still not descended into the degraded state of dualistic consciousness. In that state, you have true delight. You look at the newborn infant and a few months old and so forth. How that creature has just delight. But that, of course, is delight restricted entirely to the physical level. But for man, that delight can undergo the type of evolution which culminates in bliss, which only human beings can know. Where thought and feeling are utterly perfect, harmless. I was going to say creative, but all right, we'll leave the word creative, because I distinguish very much between creation and procreation. Procreation is true to type. Creation is bringing forth something utterly new, which never was before. We say, we use a term creative genius for a great artist or philosopher or scientist and so forth. No, he's a procreative genius. Because all that science, art, philosophy and so on are cultural developments characteristic of human beings and human society. So whatsoever is true to type is procreation. Human beings can only give birth to human beings. Elephants can't give birth to ants, and so on. You see? But when the primordial, transcendent, creative energy created the totality, that was something entirely new. It wasn't before. It wasn't in existence. With growing self-consciousness, man's mind turned inward and talked speculatively. It produced conceptions and, alas, fixed them. It exercised discriminative choice in favor of pleasure against pain. Thus, the natural, unknowing wholeness of man's being was split asunder. He was now in the state of sin, and the fundamental meaning of the word sin is whatsoever spoils or hurts or attempts to destroy the unity of the universe, the state of the total communion within the whole universe. That is sin. So man lost pure delight. Eden was no longer his. In his mind there appeared the darkness of confusion, the conflict of good with evil, of the is, of what is, with what he thought ought to be. We all have experienced that conflict of what is with what we think ought to be, and so forth. Of fact with fantasy. We must never forget, human beings normally call good whatsoever pleases them, whatsoever gratifies their desire or ambition or whatever it is. That's what they call good. And they call evil whatsoever displeases them, frustrates their desire and ambition. That's what they call evil. And they will always blame the other fellow or other fellows, you see, for their frustrations. They will never blame themselves. It took me, I think, somewhere near 50 or 60 years to cease blaming the other fellow and saying to myself, Firoz, you have been a fool there. And it creates a lot of inward disturbance, I can tell you. But it is necessary to go through that. They are our spiritual and intellectual growing pains. To be able to see oneself for exactly what oneself is. And so it is today. Only when the mind clearly knows itself for what it is, does it cease to sunder the unity of being and to obtrude upon the silence of eternity. Then sin ends with redemption and conflict cools into peace. I suppose it is true to say that the human species is the greatest noisemaker on this planet. Not only materially, airplanes and cars and God knows what not, and so forth, but also psychologically and spiritually. We obtrude upon the silence of eternity, that state of peace which is the essential condition for creation. I suppose we all of us have experienced sometime or other, or many or several times, that state of extraordinary calm, a very satisfying calm, not satisfying in the sense of a gratification of desire, but that extraordinary satisfying calm when something has been done right. In that calm, there isn't the feeling, oh, I did good there. There is only the observation, the clear, true observation, that was good. The moment one has the feeling, I did good, that good has a little poison mixed up with it. I do nothing. I am nothing. It is the totality which works through me. Not only the totality in the sense of transcendence itself, but in the material sense. Because whatsoever we do is not our exclusive activity. There are so many factors at play which find the last link in the chain in that particular action which happened through this particular psychophysical organism. We have to see it dispassionately that way. I won't say impersonally, because impersonally is not quite the right word in that context. But when action can be so perfectly dispassionate that what you see done is truly good and just good, that's all. Nothing to pat oneself on the back for, you see. Then there is an extraordinary calm and a peace. And one doesn't put it into one's ledger account as credit, into the credit column for oneself. The whole world has benefited by it. It's to the credit of all mankind, of the whole world. You see, unless we see these things clearly, there is no chance of making a beautiful and a good world, and leaving the world a better place for our having been there. It's necessary to be free of this terrible disease of selfness. Selflessness is an absolute necessity for human fruition and fulfillment. All our ambitions which we have, so many of them are just worthless ambitions altogether, that all of us here anyway have the intelligence to see should be just eschewed altogether, discarded. But we have psychological ambitions, we have spiritual ambitions. You know how often in our group meetings I have said, let us ask ourselves, why do we take to religion? What makes us get interested in yoga or meditation or this, that and the other, which is of a spiritual nature? Why do we do it? Because I want this, that or the other state of fulfillment or happiness or well-being. If the right thing is done dispassionately, selflessly, all that is good will be inevitably yours. You can't avoid it. There may be painful things. People say to me often, look at the number of people who live such good lives and they suffer horribly in life. Yes, that is also part of the story. Supposing I see something which is certainly much better than what is the usual social custom. Now, I try to live accordingly. What have I done there? I have set myself against society. And society, being by far the larger animal than this one, society generally wins and causes me pain. But that is part of the whole story of human development and evolution. So we have to realize selflessness.